We cannot turn against one another by letting this fight be defined as a war between America and Islam. That, too, is what groups like ISIL want. ISIL does not speak for Islam. They are thugs and killers, part of a cult of death. And they account for a tiny fraction of a more than a billion Muslims around the world, including millions of patriotic Muslim Americans who reject their hateful ideology. Moreover, the vast majority of terrorist victims around the world are Muslim. If we're to succeed in defeating terrorism, we must enlist Muslim communities as some of our strongest allies, rather than push them away through suspicion and hate. That does not mean denying the fact that an extremist ideology has spread within some Muslim communities. It's a real problem that Muslims must confront without excuse. Muslim leaders here and around the globe have to continue working with us to decisively and unequivocally reject the hateful ideology that groups like ISIL and Al-Qaeda promote.
I broadcast out of Portland, Oregon, and in the last week or so, my city has been in the news far more than I care to admit. What we're in the news for this time is different than what we are generally in the news for. Portland is a city with a lot of art, a lot of music, a lot of culture, a lot of political activism, and as such, we are seen as fairly progressive, and we are. In Portland, Oregon, we are progressive. There's no two ways about it. But there's a dirty little secret about Portland that a lot of people outside of Portland do not know. A lot of people inside Portland are well aware of it, even though we don't generally like to talk about it. But for those of us that are outside, or those of you who are outside of Portland, you may not realize how white Portland is, and here's why that's important. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Fire You Can't Put Out, episode number 208. My name is Melvin. I want to thank you so much for being here. So there was a religious attack carried out on our light rail in Portland, Oregon, carried out by a man with whose last name was Christian and who he himself is, well, a Christian. The man is known to police in the Portland, Oregon area. You can almost always find him at some sort of a right-wing rally, including some of the recent Trump rallies that have happened here in town. And he is always screaming some crazy right-wing stuff. Now, I say that, but allow me to qualify that. If you put a microphone in front of his mouth, and you put him on 300 or 400 radio stations like Hannity or Limbaugh, the guy would have an audience, for sure. Because that's exactly what he sounds like. When I heard him inside the courtroom screaming about how he's not a terrorist, how he's actually a patriot, it really said everything he was saying. I'm fairly certain that if the guy ever gets out of prison, they're going to give him a job on Fox News. So how did we get here? How did we get to this point? And by the way, no one is calling it terrorism. So the gentleman, and I use the term loosely, gets on the train, spots two Muslim women, or two brown-skinned women, one of them wearing a head cover, and immediately goes in to this anti-Muslim tirade. Which, by the way, right-wing radio, Fox News, Alex Jones, you guys are just as culpable in this as he is. Because the drip, drip, drip on thousands of stations for thousands of hours a week, all this right-wing anti-Muslim BS, it led directly to this. And this isn't the only one. This is only the high-profile one. And the largest reason that it's high-profile is because it happened in Portland, Oregon. And people go, wait, Portland? Portland is really, really white. Some of the history of Portland goes like this. Portland didn't admit anybody who was not brown until I think it was after 1921. This area was supposed to be a white homeland, a part of the country that resisted the freeing of the slaves. And white supremacists, and a lot of them operate in this area, have called Portland, Oregon, the future of America because of how white it is. And yes, We are progressive around here, but it's also very, very white. And the economics tend to bring about a lot of gentrification, which tends to push out minorities. And we have a radio host here in town. And this is the only radio host, it isn't me, the only radio host that comes out of Portland, Oregon, that is widely known throughout the country and perhaps throughout the world. And of course, he's a right-wing talk show host, and his name is Lars Larson. And this guy broadcasts every day with his pro-Trump, anti-Muslim, pro-gun, pro-murder, this whole thing. This thing that you can turn on any right-wing radio in here, that's this guy. And even now, with the things that are going on with Trump, this guy cannot stop suckling on the teat of Trump. He just loves him so, and it's anything that he does. And you don't get to merely consider yourself a supporter of the Trump presidency and the Trump agenda unless you're a white supremacist. There's no two ways about it. If you support this man with all of his racist talk, with all of his nativist talk, and with all of his support from all these white supremacist groups, you don't get to claim that you are not a white supremacist. I hear so much about how we're a Christian nation, you know, my brother's keeper and all this stuff. And I've always said to myself, because I was raised religious, I was raised believing in Jesus and all this, heaven and hell and all the rest. I was perpetually told as a kid that I'm going to hell because I backtalk and because I misbehave and because I listen to metal music and all this stuff. I'm over it now because I don't believe in magic anymore. But I've often wondered if they believe so much in religion, in Christianity, what book are they reading from? Because it's certainly not the book that I was reading from growing up. Quoting here, from chapter 24, and there was a split in Christianity that happened not long after the crucifixion of Christ. Quoting here, in the first 2 centuries following the crucifixion, contentious disputes broke out among the followers of the new religion, which was Christianity. After a fissiparious splitting and recombing of factions, two principal groups coalesced: the Orthodox and the Gnostics. Remember that. Two principal groups, the Orthodox and the Gnostics, they espoused irreconcilable positions. Even though their both basic beliefs and rituals identified them undeniably as Christians, the Orthodox and the Gnostics fissured over the issue of the written record of Christianity. That is, over whether or not the rapidly accumulating Gospels contained the relevant information about the religion. The Orthodox emphatically answered yes. The Gnostics adamantly stated no, holding that the Gospels were an important introduction, but that Jesus had entrusted secret knowledge to a few of his disciples that was not intended for the general public. In the late 4th century AD, Gnostics must have foreseen that the Orthodox would soon destroy their community. The Gnostics prided themselves on their lack of distinction between male and female, rich and poor, educated and lettered. They wanted to create an egalitarian church that conformed to Jesus' original message. Early Gnostics called their gatherings agape, or a love feast. Participants routinely exchanged the kiss of peace, a buss on the cheek or mouth at the close of services. Such behavior and organizational flexibility scandalized conservative Orthodox. In general, the Orthodox championed the J version of creation that placed Adam as master and Eve as contrite, compliant helpmate. The Gnostics subscribed to the E version, in which the Creator made all men and women in its image. The Orthodox often banned dancing, believing it was inspired by the devil, while many Gnostics promoted dance as the spiritual exercise. In the Gnostic Gospel of Philip, Jesus intoned, "To the universe belongs the dancer. Amen. He who does not dance does not know what happens. Amen. Now, if you follow my dance, see yourself in me, who I am speaking. Amen." So what we're looking at here are the two versions of Christianity that followed after the crucifixion. the Gnostics, which were the more progressive, and the Orthodox, which were more conservative by today's standards. And what has happened is that the Orthodox has tended to survive, while the Gnostics are considered the heretics. An eloquent Orthodox writer demanded that the faithful believe that the resurrected Christ was this flesh, suffused with blood, built up with bones, interwoven with nerves, entwined with veins, which was born and dies undoubtedly human. He warned, anyone who denies the resurrection of the flesh is a heretic, not a Christian. The Gnostics believed that the crucifixion, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ were symbolic events. They were incredulous that the Orthodox took these accounts literally. Contemptuous Gnostics referred to Orthodoxy as the faith of fools and pointed out the obvious contradictions in Orthodox arguments. For example, if Jesus was indeed a god, then how could he have suffered mortal afflictions? To the Gnostics, the Christ story was to be used as a guide. As Elaine Pagels points out, the Orthodox claim that the Gospels were history with a moral, while the Gnostics honor them because they contained myths with meaning. To the Orthodox, the written scriptures were divine revelation. In the Gnostic tradition, spiritual instructions were given and received orally. The ultimate achievement of Gnosis was to have insight of such crystalline clarity that one became a Christ. To be a Christian, to be Christ-like. The Orthodox condemned this idea as arrogant. The Gnostics derided the Orthodox claim that baptism by a priest conferred instant redemption. They viewed baptism as the first station on an arduous road to truth. The Gnostics believed that Christ's message was two-tiered, for simple folk and those unfamiliar with his teaching that were the Gospels. The second tier was reserved for the initiated. The Gnostics argued that if Jesus wanted everyone to understand his teachings on the outset, he would not have couched them in so many elliptical and confusing turns of phrase. Jesus' own saying, many are called, few are chosen. Matthew 22:14 strengthened their conviction, as did Matthew 24:12. To you has been given the secret of the kingdom of God, but for those outside, everything is parables, so that they may indeed see but not perceive, and may indeed hear but not understand. So how did we end up with the Orthodox version of Christianity, the modern conservative party, and not the Gnostics, the more progressive? In AD 313, when the Roman Emperor Constantine declared Christianity as the state religion, much like conservatives are doing now, he chose the Orthodox to administer it. A military man, Constantine favored autocratic Orthodox. He believed that the Orthodox could better help him reinvigorate Rome's declining military stature. On his cross was the inscription, in this sign, conquer, a sentiment discordant with Jesus' message. When he made the army and police available to do the Orthodox bidding, they quickly exploited their change of fortune. Within a century, they had destroyed almost all images associated with pagan shrines and closed down pagan temples. They showed little tolerance for Jews and sent few Buddhists packing. But they reserved their fiercest attacks for their fellow Christians, the Gnostics. Mobs attacked Gnostic centers and eventually destroyed all of them. Orthodox authorities ordered all Gnostic Gospels burned in AD 367. With the Gnostics driven out, the Orthodox leaders declared themselves the true patriarchs of the church. Subsequent Orthodox leaders declared themselves the true patriarchs of the church. Subsequent Orthodox leaders conferred sainthood upon Orthodox followers. They also branded Gnostics as heretics. The word gnosis is Greek for knowledge. The Greeks distinguished between episteme, knowledge acquired from facts, and gnosis, which we call intuition. In the first schism of the nascent church, the Orthodox and the Gnostics split along the lines of the hemispheres of the brain. The linear thinkers favored left brain, male-dominated patriarchies, heavy on guilt, dogma, obedience, and literalness of the Christ story. The intuitors were more often egalitarian and were entrenched by the mythopoesis of Jesus' life and death. The Orthodox consistently produced writers who were unremitting misogynists. The Gnostics intermittently produced orators articulating egalitarian and feminine principles. And it goes on.
Hi, I'm Bill O'Reilly. Thanks for watching us tonight. The Holy War begins. That is the subject of this evening's Talking Points memo.
What happened in my city is nothing less than Christian terrorism. And for one of the first times that I can recall, the man who carried out these murders said that he himself is a terrorist. He identified himself as a terrorist by saying, this is not terrorism, this is patriotism. Because he sees himself as a patriot, sees himself as a soldier in the Lord's army, fighting against those dirty, dirty heretics.
There's been a fair amount of debate in the press and among pundits about the words we use to describe and frame this challenge. So I want to be very clear about how I see it. Al-Qaeda and ISIL and groups like it are desperate for legitimacy. They try to portray themselves as religious leaders, holy warriors in defense of Islam. That's why ISIL presumes to declare itself the Islamic State. And they propagate the notion that America, and the West generally, is at war with Islam. That's how they recruit. That's how they try to radicalize young people. We must never accept the premise that they put forward, because it is a lie. Nor should we grant these terrorists the religious legitimacy that they seek. They are not religious leaders, they're terrorists. And we are not at war with Islam. We are at war with people who have perverted Islam.
I myself am not religious. I've made mention of this. But the way I see myself is much like the Gnostics. Although I don't subscribe to any particular religion, I do believe in egalitarian ideas. I do believe in feminist principles. You know, art, science, these are all my things. I don't believe in punishment. I don't believe in war. I don't believe in violence. There's a story that came out of New York recently where an aunt was watching her 4-year-old nephew. And she was trying to teach him how to spell his name. And he kept forgetting. And so she began hitting him with a belt. At one point, it got to where she was hitting him with a belt for every single word that he got wrong. Eventually, all of those lashes with the belt broke enough capillaries underneath the skin that the child, 4 years old, internally bled to death. Yeah, his skin wasn't broken and he wasn't bleeding all over the floor, but all of the bruising that was happening under the skin led to such dramatic internal bleeding that he died. She's very sad about it now, but wait a minute. I've heard people who are about to become parents, right? Babies in utero. Mom and dad are beaming, very proud. They made a baby. Like, who can't make a freaking baby? And I've heard the dad of the couple, and I won't identify them, but I've heard the dad of the couple say that, hey, he can't wait till she's born, because the first time she gets lippy with him, she's going to get a taste of the back of his hand. What are we doing? There is a lot of Orthodox Christianity in that statement. He himself is a Christian, the dad who said that. My mom, when she punished us growing up, used to say, hey, it says right in the Bible, don't spare the rod. And they referred to it as child rearing. I've heard more than a few folks say, the reason I turned out so good was because I got my ass whooped by my parents. That's not the... A lot of that is Orthodox Christian. So is it really so ridiculous that same belief, that persistent belief that came out of Orthodox Christianity, that violence is the way that you bring up somebody, violence is the way that you solve a problem, violence is the way that you get other people to believe in your religion, is it really all that ridiculous that there is so much Christian terrorism now? No, it isn't. The only part that's really ridiculous is that for some reason we refuse to identify it as that. If this man who killed 2 people on the MAX train, if he were brown skin, he doesn't even have to be Muslim, if he were brown skin, his face would be plastered everywhere. There would be right-wing militia groups on every train in America. So they're just here to protect America. But because he's white, because he's a Christian, with the exception of here in Portland, Oregon, the story has already kind of died.
When it comes to a woman having to make a very personal choice, in that case, my Republican colleagues love the government and want the government to make that choice for every woman in America. If that's not hypocrisy, I don't know what hypocrisy is.
So often we're told that we should just believe in ourselves and in one another and Christian principles, and we don't need the state. All we need are the states and the church. That's all we need. You know, we don't need taxes and we don't need welfare. We just need charities. And we need charities and rich people. And that's all that we need. Conservatives don't hate government. They just hate government that doesn't serve rich people. I mentioned this time last year, and I've brought it up a few times, and I'm going to continue to bring it up because I believe it, and believe it quite strongly. Mark Melvin's words, and if I'm wrong, I will come onto this microphone, and I was, God dang, I was wrong. But I don't think I'm wrong about this. So I said that after Donald Trump became the nominee, that was the death of the Republican Party. Whether or not he becomes president, the Republican Party, in effect, just died. And there's a gigantic concern right now with terrorism. And they believe that the terrorism is all coming from Islam. But actually, the vast majority, the overwhelming majority of terrorism is coming from the Christian right. The Southern Poverty Law Center tracks hate groups in America. They track about two dozen, maybe two and a half dozen hate groups in America. Let me list them. The alternative right. I think that one's fairly explanatory. Anti-immigrant. Okay. Also, the anti-LGBT. Uh-huh. Anti-Muslim. Now, that's interesting. Alternative right, which are the white supremacists. Anti-immigrant, conservative. Anti-LGBT, conservative. Anti-Muslim, conservative. The anti-government movement. Conservatives. Christian identity. Christian identity is a unique anti-Semitic and racist theology that rose to a position of commanding influence on the racist right in the 1980s. Christian, in name only, the movement's relationship with evangelicals and fundamentalists has generally been hostile due to the latter's belief. General hate. Hate music. Holocaust denial. The Ku Klux Klan. Neo-Confederate. These are the people that run around with the Confederate flag. Neo-Nazi, racist skinhead, radical traditional Catholicism, the sovereign citizens movement, white nationalism. So these are all the groups that they track, with the exception of one, the black separatist group. Black separatists typically oppose integration and racial intermarriage, and they want separate institutions or even a separate nation just for black people. But out of all these groups that I read, all of them are on the conservative right, on the right side of the political spectrum. They all come from the right. There's a reason why conservatives hate the Southern Poverty Law Center. And that's because they see them as, they just see them as anti-conservative and anti-freedom and all these other things. But the real problem is that most of the hate that's being carried out in America, most of the terrorism that's being carried out on our own soil, is homegrown. They're not brown-skinned, and they're not carrying it out with suicide bombs. They're white, they're Christian, they're almost always male, and it's usually done with a gun. Now, I understand that the gentleman this weekend did it with a knife, but it's usually carried out with a gun.
The church doesn't like for people to grow up because you can't control grown-ups. That's why we talk about being born again. When you're born again, you're still a child. The people don't need to be born again. They need to grow up. They need to accept their responsibility for themselves and the world.
There's another movement on the conservative right that's also super interesting to me, and that is the self-identified pro-life movement. Now, the reason that's interesting is because when you think about cutting food stamps, when you think about cutting health care, when you think about cutting even foreign aid, when you think about cutting funding to schools, which also feeds children, you know, think about cutting heating assistance and housing assistance, it would seem to me that those things are fairly anti-life. But conservatives, in general, generally the Catholics, tend to see themselves as pro-life. But what does that mean? Well, that means that we want you to be born. But outside of that, you know, once you're born, you're on your own. You know, what are you doing here, moocher? The conservative movement is that it has a lot of contradictions. It doesn't make a lot of sense. And I would like to think that I'm not this hard left ideologue. I would love to point to some things that conservatives believe in and say, you know what? I'm there with conservatives on that issue or on that issue. And I've racked my brain about this. And I'm not with them on a single issue. And that's not necessarily their problem. Perhaps that's my problem. Maybe I'm narrow-minded. But it would seem to me that there should be something somewhere where we overlap. And on every single issue, it seems that we don't. Now, I could point out some things. I could speak in generalities and say, I want this, and I think you want this, and I want this, and I think that you want this. But if you really dig down, the way they would like to achieve it is much different than the way that I want to achieve it. So here's where we're at. We have a conservative party in America. We have a right-wing party in America that values war, that values exacerbating climate change, that values starving people, that values stripping people of their access to health care, that values war, that values holy war. And it really has become an anti-life party. Recently, Trump decided to pull us out of the Paris Accord, of the Paris Agreement. And by the way, the Paris Accord, the agreement, has nothing to do with Paris itself. He said he's protecting Pittsburgh instead of not just Paris. But it's ridiculous because, first of all, and he was using alliteration there because he thinks he's clever. Ha ha, he found two words that begin with P. But the Paris Accord was really just an agreement between 194 countries. Syria, Nicaragua, and now the United States are the only three countries that aren't a part of the Paris Accord. Three: Nicaragua, Syria, the United States of America. That's it. We are giving up our leadership position. The Republicans, who call us the greatest country, the greatest people, the greatest leaders in the world, they have decided that the way to celebrate that, or the way to exhibit that, is to give up our leadership position in the world. Of course, the other countries, the UK, Mexico, China, they've said that they're going to go ahead and take more of a leadership position. Climate change is a gigantic problem, and it's only getting worse. It's leading to extreme weather. It's leading to dried up crops, you know, people starving. It's wiping out species. It's wiping out thousands of species a day. There's thousands. How's it? It's thousands because we don't consider organisms, like little microorganisms. We don't consider those species, but they are. And we're losing thousands of those a day. And so what Trump said, in effect, and I believe this was pointed out by either the New York, no, not the New York Post, New York Daily News, I think it was, or the New York Times, I can't remember, it was one of the New York papers. The headline was Trump to World, Drop Dead. And that's effectively what's going to happen. What he just did, what he decided to do with pulling out of the Paris Accord, when we create something like 25% of the world's waste, we've decided not to take a leadership position on reducing that waste, not reducing the things that we dump in the air, all the things that cause cancer and asthma and global warming and all the rest. By doing that, he's decided that it's way more important for industries to be able to make money, even if that means we're going to kill more people while we get there. With the conservative right waving the flag of pro-life, right, and saying that they're just doing God's work, how did it get to be this way? And why are there so many of us that are willing to believe this fairy tale that they are pro-life, that they do care? Dr. Elizabeth Blackburn is the winner of the 2009 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine, and she's the president of the Salk Institute for Biological Studies. Salk Institute, that's from Jonas Salk. Jonas Salk was the guy who came up with the polio vaccine, and when he came up with it, they said, so you want to patent this? He said, no, I don't want to patent it because I want people to get better. He said, this is my gift to humanity. And Elizabeth Blackburn wrote an article for Time Magazine. The headline, when did we start to value killing over living? As human beings, we're hardwired to stay alive. Neuroscientists explained that evolution has installed survival instincts in our brains, equipping us with a strong will to live. Thus, when pummeled by capricious catastrophes, stripped of possessions, metaphorically sent back to go, we nevertheless emerge saying, at least I'm alive. And then we forge on, because above all else, we value life. So in the recent proposed federal budget, I moved to wonder, when did we start to value killing over living? She's talking about Trump's budget. This budget, which increases defense spending by $54 billion, enabling us to fire more guns and drop bigger bombs and shoot deadlier missiles at the same time, decimates funding for the National Institutes of Health, the organization actively helping us to live longer and healthier lives, if approved. And we won't know until September. The proposed cuts of $5.8 billion, a roughly 20% decrease from the 2017 spending, will drastically and illogically throttle the very accomplishments that are extending our lives. In recent years, NIH funding has led to medical breakthroughs that include cholesterol-lowering drugs, molecular targets for halting cancer spread, and early diagnostics for neurological diseases. Every day, because of NIH's monetary support, scientific researchers at America's top institutions continue to announce new insights that are pointing the way to more effective medical treatments and longer lives. And the pace of discovery is accelerating. Thanks to a rise in interdisciplinary collaboration, physicists working with biologists who consult with medical doctors and meet with sociologists, truly novel strategies for confronting disease are well underway. We find ourselves, after decades of scientific research, in a position to move from battling a disease only after it's been diagnosed to effectively intercepting it before it even spreads. Because gutting NIH funding won't simply suspend scientific research, it will kill it. Long-term studies will be shelved. Laboratory teams with deep expertise that takes years to acquire will rapidly disintegrate. All of that incisive work and accumulated insight will have been for nothing. We'll lose all the ability to respond to the next national catastrophe. What if, as many military experts predict, the next terrorist attack is a biological one, and we're not going to have any good way to fight it because we are taking away from all of those scientists that work at the NIH. We're taking away all of their resources. But we are going to increase our military spending by $54 billion. So we're not going to prevent diseases, which is the cheaper, more effective, and less painful way to take care of diseases. We're only going to be able to take care of them after they've hit hard, after people are super duper sick, and where there's less of a chance of making them better or even saving them. That's when, and even then, we probably won't. So what are we doing by increasing the amount that we spend on military spending by $54 billion while stripping money from scientists that cure our diseases? What are we protecting? What are we spending so much money to protect while we are rapidly taking away the things that we claim to be protecting?
Before Republican vice presidential candidate Governor Mike Pence took the podium yesterday at the town hall, a 12-year-old Trump supporter just brought the house down. Denver 7's Mark Boyle caught up with a kid who's rallying Trump supporters who can't even vote yet.
I believe we must make America great again. That is why I founded Colorado Kids for Trump.
He's a young kid with big ideas.
Kids and parents should have free school choice across the nation.
And 12-year-old Weston Eimer is rallying other children now to support Donald Trump's campaign through his newly formed Colorado Kids for Trump.
We are a group of kids that support Mr. Trump and Mike Pence's ideas.
Weston Eimer was an interesting one to me during the campaign. This is a kid for Trump. Does he really even know what he's doing? Here's what we're teaching when we teach kids that somebody who admits to sexual assault, somebody who's on his third wife, somebody who makes these awful, awful deals, somebody who has only ever served the rich in his life and continues to only ever serve the rich, when we teach our kids that that is somebody to look up to, let's strip away everything else and only take the sexual assault thing into account. We've decided that somebody who admitted on tape to sexually assaulting women, who was being sued by dozens of women who say they were sexually assaulted in that very way, we've decided that that is the person that we should look up to. President Clinton was impeached in the House. Although it failed in the Senate, he was impeached in the House. Does anyone remember what he was impeached for? Yeah, they tried to say that, well, he was impeached for lying, but they tried to say that he was a sexual deviant. He's perverted. You know, and they were so upset that he cheated on Hillary Clinton, which just sounds so weird. But they got to impeach him, right? Because, oh my God, the moral high ground and all the rest. But what about Trump? All of a sudden, that's not a good reason to remove somebody from office anymore. And then to teach our kids that this is somebody to look up to, somebody to idolize, somebody to follow, just poisons the children of tomorrow.
Hey, Jefferson, I'm good. You?
In one of the most important elections of our lifetime.
I understand you signed up to volunteer for the Trump campaign.
In one of the most important counties in the state.
Mom.
The Donald Trump campaign is relying on 12-year-old Weston Eimer.
I am the co-chair for the Jefferson County Trump campaign.
That's true. He really was the co-chair. He was the guy running the operations in that state. Because, couple things. It really wasn't important to Donald Trump to win the election. He didn't want to. He didn't care. He didn't want to be president then. He doesn't want to be president now. So much so that he put a 12-year-old in charge in one of the states. And yet, Donald still became president. Now, there's any number of reasons for that. And not the least of which is, you know, of course, the Democrats blew it. There was hacking in the election. And then our moneyed system just brings us people like this. But conservatives want to make sure that we continue to have kids like this in the future. This from the Washington Post. In Arizona, teachers can now be hired with absolutely no training in how to teach. The only thing that they would really like you to have is a belief in God. Quoting here, new legislation signed into law in Arizona by Republican Governor Doug Ducey, Republican, will allow teachers to be hired with no formal teaching training as long as they've got 5 years of experience in fields relevant to the subject they are teaching. What's relevant, though, isn't clear. The legislation was championed by Ducey, who has described it as a positive change that will entice great teachers to come into the classroom and help alleviate Arizona's teacher shortages. A new analysis by the National Education Association found that Arizona is near the bottom of a state list of spending per student. In 2015 to 2016, the latest data available, the U.S. average per student expenditure was $11,787. Vermont had the highest at $23,557, and Arizona was near the bottom at $7,566. Teacher salaries in Arizona were near the bottom 20% of states. Teachers' unions and the elected state superintendent of public instruction, Diane Douglas, opposed the law, with Douglas issuing a statement saying that lowering the standards for new teachers is not the way to correct the problem. A retired teacher named Mike McClellan wrote in the Arizona Republic, quote, "Let's call it the warm body law, one that allows folks without any teaching credentials to lead our kids in the classrooms across Arizona, as long as those men and women have at least 5 years experience in relevant fields. And those fields, it doesn't matter." So we've decided to lower the standards for education. If you flip over to conservative talk radio, outside of all of the anti-Muslim and anti-immigrant stuff that you'll hear, you'll also hear no shortage of them slamming teachers. Teachers, teachers' unions, professors, artists, actors, writers. These, we tend to think that the military leaders and politicians, and these are the best and brightest that we've got. But I would submit to you that our artists, that our intellectuals, those are the best that we have. This is, of course, where conservatives disagree with me. They will spend a ton of time. And I have a friend right now that I've known for some time who discovered conservative talk radio a couple years ago. And I'm pretty certain I'm slowly watching him morph into a conservative. And he's got a Twitter account. I've seen on his Twitter account, I've seen even him going after college teachers, after professors. And this is just a part of conservative. Yeah, he listens to the show, or he did it one time. He probably doesn't anymore, which is why I feel very comfortable talking right here. Hi, hi. I know who you are. You know. So, but when they're tearing apart teachers, you know, the bright people in our society, we have to wonder why? Why tear apart our educators? And that is because ignorance is really what's become important to this crowd. There's an article over at Raw Story by David Edwards. The headline, farm workers get sick after Trump's EPA reverses Obama and approves poison that damages kids' brains. Quoting here, dozens of farm workers were pulled out of the fields after they were poisoned by a chemical that was recently approved by President Donald Trump's administration, even though the previous administration, Obama's administration, had taken steps to ban it. KTEG reported that at least 50 farm workers were exposed to the pesticide on Friday, causing cabbage harvesting operations to be shut down at Dan Andrews Farms. Quote, we started getting an odor, pesticide odor, coming in from the mandarin orchards west of our field, Dan Andrews supervisor Efron Zavala told the station. Zavala explained that the Vulcan pesticide, which contains a poison called, hold on, I'm going to screw this name up, chlorpyrifos, was sprayed on the orchards the night before workers came to work in the cabbage fields. Quote, I'm not pointing fingers or saying it was done incorrectly. It's just an unfortunate thing the way that it has drifted. The wind came and pushed everything east, and we were caught in the path, that he said. KTEG confirmed that 12 people reported symptoms of vomiting, nausea, and one person fainted. The station also noted that more than half of the 50 workers left the scene before medical services arrived. Why did they leave the field before medical services arrived? Because they are undocumented workers and they are working in Trump's America. So we've got this poison, which is a pesticide. And we've said we're going to stop using it because it causes neurological damage in kids' brains. And then Scott Pruitt comes in for the EPA, thanks to Donald Trump. And he says, oh, this poison, this horrible, terrible, no good, very bad poison, we're going to bring it back because screw science.
Trust me, I'm like a smart person.
I have spoken as recently as 24 hours ago with people at the highest level of intelligence, and I asked them the question, does it work? Does torture work? And the answer was yes, absolutely.
You're now the president. Do you want waterboarding?
I will rely on Pompeo and Mattis and my group. And if they don't want to do, that's fine. If they do want to do, then I will work toward that end. I want to do everything within the bounds of what you're allowed to do legally. But do I feel it works? Absolutely, I feel it works.
He wants to do what we are allowed to legally do. Here's the interesting thing about legal. It's legal when we say that it's legal, and we can make anything legal. Slavery was legal. Lynching was legal. We decide what's legal and what's not legal. And now that he has his lawyers in there, right, just like John Yoo with President George W. Bush, now that he's got his lawyers in there and he's got legislators that want to do what he wants to do, what's going to be legal is whatever the hell he wants them to do.
One of the things that Donald Trump also said on Thursday night again is that we should have taken the oil of Iraq. Even if you could do that practically, and most experts say you couldn't, wouldn't that just be theft?
Well, no. He said take it so that the Islamic State then would not have had it available.
But he said leave a force back there and take it.
Leave a force back there and take it and make sure it's distributed in a proper way. And basically,
that's not legal, is it?
Of course it's legal. It's a war. Until the war is over, anything's legal.
Isn't that hilarious? Of course it's legal. It's a war.
Of course it's legal. It's a war. Until the war is over, anything's legal.
So recently, a gentleman named Ben Ferencz made an appearance on 60 Minutes. The headline, "What the Last Nuremberg Prosecutor Alive Wants the World to Know." Ben Ferencz, this is from CBS, is the last Nuremberg prosecutor alive, and he has a message for the world. Just some backstory here. 22 SS officers responsible for the deaths of over 1 million people would have never been brought to justice had it not been for Ben Ferencz, 97 years old. The officers were part of units called Einsatzgruppen, or action groups. Their job was to follow the German army as it invaded the Soviet Union in 1941 and killed communists, gypsies, and Jews. Ferencz believes that war makes murderers out of otherwise decent people, and he has spent his life working to deter war crimes. Quoting here, "If it's naive to want peace instead of war, let them say that I'm naive, because," he states, "I want peace and not war." There were 3,000 SS officers trained for the purpose and directed to kill without pity or remorse every single Jewish man, woman, and child they can lay their hands on. This was their assignment. Come in behind the troop, round up the Jews, and kill them all. Whenever they would ask these SS members, "Are you guilty or not guilty?" they would always say, "Not guilty." Quoting here, but Ferencz knew they were guilty and he could prove it. Without calling a single witness, he entered into evidence the defendants' own reports of what they had done. Exhibit 111, "In the last 10 weeks, we've liquidated around 55,000 Jews." Exhibit 179 from Kiev, 1941, "The city's Jews were ordered to present themselves, about 34,000 reported, including women and children. After they had been made to give up their clothing and valuables, all of them were killed, which took several days." Exhibit 84, from Einsatzgruppen D, "In March 1942, the total number of executed so far, 91,678. They kept meticulous records on this. Einsatzgruppen D was the unit of Ferencz's lead defendant, Otto Orlandorf. He didn't deny the killings, and he had the gall to claim that they were all in self-defense. So Leslie Stahl asks, "Did you look at the defendants' faces?" Ferencz, "Defendants' faces were blank all the time. Defendants, absolutely blank. They could, like they were waiting for a bus. All 22 defendants were found guilty, and 4 of them were hanged." Ferencz says his goal from the beginning was to affirm the rule of law and deter similar crimes from ever happening again. War makes murderers out of otherwise decent people. All wars and all decent people. Ben Ferencz says, "Of course, is my answer. These men would have never been murderers had it not been for the war. These were people who could quote Goethe, who loved Wagner, who were polite." Leslie Stahl says, "What turns a man into a savage beast like that?" Ferencz says, "He's not a savage. He's an intelligent, patriotic human being." Stahl, "He's a savage when he does murder, though." Ferencz, "No, he's a patriotic human acting in the best interests of his country. That's what's in his mind." Ferencz has spent the rest of his life, post-Nuremberg, trying to deter war crimes by establishing an international court like Nuremberg. He scored a victory when the International Criminal Court in The Hague was created in 1998. He delivered the closing argument in the court's first case. Quote, "If they tell me they want war instead of peace, I don't say they're naive, I say they're stupid." Leslie Stahl, "Now you've been at this for 50 years, if not more. We've had genocide since then." He says, "Yes." Leslie Stahl points out, "In Cambodia." And he says, "Yeah, it's going on right this minute." Leslie Stahl says, "Going on right this minute in Sudan." And he says, "Yes." Leslie Stahl says, "We've had Rwanda, Bosnia." And she says, "Hey, Ben, you're not getting very far." And he says, "Don't say that. People get discouraged. They should remember from me, it takes courage to not be discouraged." It's naive to want peace instead of war. Then let them say I'm naive because I want peace instead of war. If they tell me they want war instead of peace, I don't say they're naive. I say they're stupid. Stupid to an incredible degree to send young people out to kill other young people that they don't even know, who never did anybody any harm, never harmed them. This is the current system. I'm naive? That's insane. Allow me to bring this back around with a closing statement. So the idea that we operate underneath right now with respect to religion and Christianity in America, we've decided to subscribe to a very brutal form of Christianity. We've taken our United States foreign policy and decided to do that which enriches these companies that profiteer off of war, these military contractors, these people that make money off of war. We've decided to take all of the money that we spend domestically, providing for and protecting our people, and we've decided to instead go into foreign lands and kill people. And then when those people decide to come to our land and begin killing our people, we say, well, now we've got a religious war on our hands. War, 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 war. And when it's war, it turns otherwise decent people into killers, into savages. But they don't see it that way. They see themselves as patriots, doing what's in the best interest of their country, doing what they were told, doing what they're supposed to be doing if they want to protect their homeland. And that's why we have that word in our language, homeland, because you want to feel, you want, if you really want people to commit atrocities, you want them to feel like their home is being invaded. But it's not the house that they live in, it's the homeland. So you say, your homeland is being taken over by these people. You spread racism, you spread nativism, and then you get people to do your bidding for you. You get them to do your beatings and your killing and whatever you want them to do. War, whether it be at home or abroad, does the same thing, always with the same result. Never have we just chosen to go to war because we want to make our military contractors richer, and has it made anything better? Has it made us more prosperous? It's never done anything for us. And when you take something as stupid as war, which shouldn't even exist in this day, and you go ahead and you insert religion into it, you can get anybody to do any awful thing, no matter how awful it is. And we've decided in America that we are completely okay with white people committing acts of terrorism. It's only a problem if brown people decide to commit those same acts. Trump banned people from 7 or 8 Muslim countries, right? Muslim countries that had never ever carried out an attack in America. This past weekend, more people were killed by right-wing white Christian terrorists than have been killed by anybody from those 7 countries over the last 50 years. More people were killed at home by homegrown white Christian terrorists. And this doesn't mean that Christianity is a bad thing, because it's not. But if you subscribe to a very brutal form of Christianity, we can only anticipate that this is going to be the outcome. When good Christians and Catholics say that the way to solve this problem is for us to listen to conservative politicians and to continue to go to war, to continue to kill innocent people, to continue to kill with bombs and guns and drones and all the rest, then those atrocities are just going to continue to be carried out. And they're going to be carried out without a second thought. Because remember, we're doing this in the name of patriotism, and we're doing this in the name of religion. I know I'm not saying anything new here. And for, by and large, for the people that listen to this show, the people in this audience, I definitely know that I'm not saying anything that you don't know. But sometimes I feel like these things need to be said out loud, so that we can consider them deeper, so that we can really think about what we're doing and why we're doing it. I don't kill because I think it's wrong. I don't think that killing is okay. I myself don't want to be killed. I don't want anyone that I know to be killed. And I know that even if I got so angry at someone else that I said, dang it, I want you dead, I don't really mean it. I don't really want anyone dead. And I don't know what it takes for a person to not only get to that point, but to carry out the murders. When the last survivor, and that's what Ben Pharenx is, when the last survivor who remembers the last atrocity, when that person dies, the next atrocity is inevitable. Ben is 97 years old, and he's trying to tell us where we went wrong and what was in these men's minds. And there's not a lot of people listening to him. And he's 97. He doesn't have long left. And when he's gone, it won't take us long to commit that same atrocity. With respect to the planet is going to be fine, just fine without us. What we're doing right now is merely saying to her that we don't care about her, that we're going to continue to extract and burn and pollute. And what she's going to say to us is, whoop, time for another mass extinction, where she wipes out 97% of all life on Earth. And then it'll take a million years with all the people gone, all of our stuff gone, everything being destroyed. The Earth will reset itself. And if it feels like it, in another million years, it might bring us back. Or it might just say, you know what? I'm sick of people. I bring you people back. You destroy me. You destroy each other. It's amazing to me that with all the knowledge that we have, this is still the road that we continue to go down. But to have hope is courageous. To believe that we can change is courageous. Because remember, that really flies in the face of everything that we're seeing play out right now. But I'm not going to change the way I act. I'm not going to change the way I think. I'm not going to change the way I am. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here on The Fire You Can't Put Out. Our official home is tfycpo.podbean.com. Like us on Facebook, facebook.com/tfycpo. You can listen on the go. Just download the Podbean app at the iTunes Store or at the Google Play Store for Android users. Individual episodes are available for download at the iTunes Store. Just search for The Fire You Can't Put Out. There you can also subscribe so that you never miss an episode. Questions, comments, or hate mail, just a general statement or inquiry, you can email us at tfycpo@gmail.com. We work hard to not only inform and entertain, but also keep an open dialogue with our growing listener base. So feel free to reach out to us. And as always, thank you for listening. We are the fire you can't put out, and we will prevail, rejecting austerity in favor of prosperity. Special thanks to Kevin for producing, and a special thanks to you for listening. This is Melvin, signing off. Now that I've woken you up, stay woke. Good morning.